of an initiation rite, in which new members of the president's staff were ordered to prove their mettle by screwing an enemy of the White House. Maybe the Canuck letter had been Clausen's initiation rite, winning him a fraternity paddle with the presidential seal from his new brothers in the USC Mafia. Bradley, Simons, Rosenfeld, and Sussman joined the discussion around Woodward's typewriter. All pretense of security had been abandoned, and word spread through the newsroom. Clausen had written the Canuck letter, and there was a package of stories coming that would go through the White House like a rocket. It was decided that Berger should try to lunch with Clausen that afternoon and see if he would repeat himself. Meanwhile, she filed a memo describing her conversation with Clausen. Memo from M. Berger. Eyes only. On the evening of September 25, 1972, at approximately 8:30 p.m., Ken Clausen telephoned me at my apartment to invite me out for a drink. I said I had already eaten dinner, was very tired, but if he wanted to come over for a drink, he could. I invited him because he had called twice before with the same invitation in the course of the previous weeks, and I had said no each time. When Ken arrived, I offered him a drink. He accepted scotch. I forget if it was with water or soda, but I know he took ice. We sat down to talk. I had Sanka. In the course of the discussion, I would say about the first 10 minutes or so, we started talking about being a reporter and being a government official. He said we reporters knew only a fraction of what goes on. I asked him if now that he was in the White House, he would be a better reporter when he left. He said he had covered the White House before, but could really cover it now. He may have said something about knowing where all the bodies are buried, but I'm not absolutely sure of that. It was then that he said, I wrote the letter. I think he said the Canuck letter, but in any case he clearly announced that he wrote that Muskie letter. I was so shocked, I felt queasy. I asked him why. He said it was because Muskie was the candidate who would represent the strongest opposition, and they wanted him out. When I said Muskie must have reacted beyond all their expectations, he indicated yes. I then asked him whether he had done that kind of thing when he was a reporter, i.e., that kind of dishonest thing. He said no, that he was a straight, honest reporter. I asked how he could do such a thing as write that letter, and that's when he said, that's politics. That's the way things are. In the course of that conversation that evening, he also spoke with enormous praise of Nixon, particularly about what a great guy he is, how warm he is, what a joker he is, and how the president is always warning him and John Scali, now ambassador to the United Nations, to behave. This is the part of the conversation that evening that dealt with the Canuck letter and related matters. Naturally, we spoke about a number of other things. Berger, a 37-year-old former reporter for Newsday, is a diplomatic specialist. She knew that she was about to become part of the story, a situation that is congenitally distressing to reporters, but she reacted to her sudden appearance in the midst of the Watergate excitement with self-possession. Clausen accepted her invitation for a 1 o'clock lunch. Berger returned to the office about 3 and filed another memo. Lunch at Sans Souci. He bought. I told Ken that Woodward and Bernstein were onto a big story, of which the Canuck letter was a part, that they had traced it to the White House, and that I had said, that's not new, Ken said he did it. Ken looked very serious, as he had throughout the lunch. Dr. Lukacs, President Nixon's doctor, had just told him some days before that he has high blood pressure, and he has to watch what he eats and drinks. He acted like he had determined to get off drinking altogether and to lose weight. He ordered a Caesar salad and didn't even finish it. He also mentioned that it takes a lot out of him when he has to dress down other officials, especially cabinet officials. I asked him if he indeed dresses down cabinet officials, and he said he does. Concerning the Canuck letter, he said he wished I hadn't said that to the boys. I said I didn't know that was anything new. He said that Woodward and Bernstein can't possibly have traced it to the White House, or it can't possibly have been traced to the White House. On the statement to me, he said he would deny it on a stack of Bibles over his mother's grave. He dropped it, then returned to it, asking what they had. I told him I wasn't entirely sure, but on the letter part, they had traced some fellow from New England who went to Florida for the muskie thing, etc. I was very vague. He said he would deny it. Later he returned to it, and asked if I wanted to take down what he wanted to say about it, or if I wanted to let them, Woodward and Bernstein, call. Then he said, better let them call. Bradley, the other editors, and Bernstein and Woodward studied Berger's memo. Clausen hadn't denied saying that he had written the letter. Woodward called Clausen at the White House. Now Clausen asserted that he had not admitted writing the letter in the first place, and that the entire matter was a misunderstanding. Woodward said that the editors believed Berger, and that the Post was going to use what she had reported. Clausen said, "That's your privilege. I just hope you include my denial. Marilyn misunderstood. She's a professional and did not deliberately do anything unprofessional. We were just shooting the breeze about the election. We were not in an interview situation." Woodward asked where all this shooting the breeze had taken place. Clausen said he didn't recall. Woodward asked if Clausen had ever known Berger to get anything wrong or misquote someone. Clausen, growing more annoyed, lashed out. "You're not going to ask a bullshit question like that. Don't give me that crap. That's straight out of Wichita, Kansas. She writes in the area of foreign affairs, and I don't read very much in foreign affairs. I don't know how to answer that." Clausen maintained that the first time he had heard of the Canuck letter was when I saw it on television, following Muskie's February 26th appearance. "I know nothing about it, aside from that," he insisted. Shortly after the conversation with Clausen, Berger rushed over to Woodward's desk. "Ken Clausen is on the telephone. What should I do?" Woodward thought perhaps Clausen was going to make some sort of personal plea to Berger. No one at the Post doubted that Clausen had told Berger he had written the letter. But they all tended to believe that he had been bragging and oversimplifying. It seemed likely that he had merely had a hand in the episode, and that he had taken the credit for it. Both possibilities seemed in character. When Clausen was on the national staff at the Post, he had a habit of leaving off the bylines of local reporters who occasionally worked with him on stories. While Berger left Clausen on hold, a secretary got on an extension to transcribe. Clausen seemed much less concerned about the Canuck letter than the circumstances in which he and Berger had discussed it. "It just occurs to me, where were we when this alleged conversation took place?" Clausen asked Berger.
"Alleged conversation? Are you denying—"
"Look, I said it was a misunderstanding. I said I thought you were a fine reporter, and we probably had a misunderstanding." Berger said something about a drink. "Can't we have had it in a restaurant?" Clausen asked.
"No," Berger said, "because it had been at her apartment."
"Are you serious?"
"No. Christ. You're going to tell them that?"
"I told them already."
"You told them that?"
"Well, you did come over for a drink."
"Well, for Christ's sake.
What's wrong with coming over for a drink?"
"Are you kidding?"
"No," she said.
"You and me in your apartment?"
"Well,
you've already told them that?"
Clausen said.
"Jesus Christ. Well, you've just shot me down. If it appears in the paper that I'm over at your house having a drink, do you know what that does?"
"I don't see why."
"You don't?"
"No. I have a clear conscience."
"Jesus Christ. Who did you tell?"
"I told the guys."
"That's incredible. Just incredible," he repeated.
"I don't see what's so wrong about that.
Marilyn, I have a wife and family and a dog and a cat."
"Well, I have lots of people come over to my house for a drink."
"Oh, boy, that's the worst blow."
"There's nothing bad about it."
"Well, there sure is."
"It shouldn't look bad," Berger insisted.
"Incredible, just incredible."
"It's incredible that you're so upset about that, when this other thing is really substantive," Berger told him. There was a long silence.
"Okay, amazing."
"I have nothing to be embarrassed about,"
Berger said. That's the most embarrassing thing of all. He hung up.
A few minutes later, Clausen called Bradley to ask that the Post not say he had been in Marilyn Berger's apartment during the conversation. Bradley wasn't interested in where the conversation had taken place, aside from the fact that it gave him leverage over Clausen. He had had no intention of even hinting at the context of the conversation in print. Clausen denied to Bradley, too, that he had claimed authorship of the letter or had anything to do with it. At about 6 p.m., the editors and Bernstein and Woodward had a final meeting with Bradley on the stories.
"What do you have and how are you saying it?" Bradley asked. The reporters had abandoned the earlier plan for three stories. Instead, Woodward was writing an account of the Canuck letter, including Clausen's alleged role. And Bernstein was writing a Segretti espionage sabotage story. Copies of the half-finished accounts were passed to Bradley. He brought his chair close to his oval table desk, held his hand in the air to request silence, and began reading. Simons was reading another set of carbons. Rosenfeld nervously swiveled his orange chair in quarter turns. Occasionally whispered comments went back and forth. Sussman sat quietly with his legs crossed.
"Fellas," Bradley broke the silence, "you've got one story here. Put it into one, fit it together. It's all part of the same thing."
He turned his chair 180 degrees to his own typewriter on the ledge behind the oval table, opened a drawer, and pulled out a piece of two-ply paper.
"Never mind the first several paragraphs," Bradley said. "You work that out."
He began on a section which would deal with Clausen and the letter. He banged out two long paragraphs, then flipped the page across the table to Woodward. Bernstein, meanwhile, went to his desk and wrote, "FBI agents have established that the Watergate bugging incident stemmed from a massive campaign of political spying and sabotage conducted on behalf of President Nixon's re-election and directed by officials of the White House and the Committee for the Re-election of the President. The activities, according to information in FBI and Department of Justice files, were aimed at all the major Democratic presidential contenders and, since 1971, represented a basic strategy of the Nixon re-election effort." Bernstein passed the draft around, first to Woodward and then to the editors who had gathered around his desk. All agreed. Not a word was changed. Unusual on such a sensitive story, especially given the number of editors involved. Woodward added the third paragraph. "During their Watergate investigation, federal agents established that hundreds of thousands of dollars in Nixon campaign contributions had been set aside to pay for an extensive undercover campaign aimed at discrediting individual Democratic presidential candidates and disrupting their campaigns. And, from suggestions made primarily by Sussman, the fourth paragraph. Intelligence work is normal during a campaign, and is said to be carried out by both political parties. But federal investigators said what they uncovered being done by the Nixon forces is unprecedented in scope and intensity." Despite lack of specific examples, the crucial fifth and sixth paragraphs related that the espionage and sabotage included following members of Democratic candidates' families, assembling dossiers of their personal lives, forging letters and distributing them under the candidates' letterheads, leaking false and manufactured items to the press, throwing campaign schedules into disarray, seizing confidential campaign files and investigating the lives of dozens of Democratic campaign workers. In addition, investigators said the activities included planting provocateurs in the ranks of organizations expected to demonstrate at the Republican and Democratic conventions, and investigating potential donors to the Nixon campaign before their contributions were solicited. Woodward called Shumway, CRP's principal spokesman, read in the first six paragraphs, and outlined the Segretti business and the allegations involving Clausen and the letter.
"Now, read me that again," Shumway said, apparently stunned.
Woodward repeated,
"That's one I'll have to get back to you on," Shumway said. "Now let me get it straight. You're doing that for tomorrow? This never ceases to amaze me."
Shumway called back an hour later saying, "Now, are you ready? We've got a statement. The Post story is not only fiction, but a collection of absurdities." Woodward waited. "That's it," Shumway said. Woodward asked about specific points. "It's no use, Robert," said Shumway. "That's all we're going to say. The entire matter is in the hands of the authorities." To Woodward and Bernstein, the latest non-denial seemed to confirm their account. The two lead paragraphs, with their sweeping statements about massive political espionage and sabotage directed by the White House as part of a basic re-election strategy, were essentially interpretive and risky. No source had explicitly told the reporters that the substance represented the stated conclusions of the federal investigators. But they knew that there was information in the files of the FBI and the Justice Department to support their conclusions. The story was based on strains of evidence, statements from numerous sources, deduction, a partial understanding of what the White House was doing, the reporters' familiarity with the switchblade mentality of the president's men, and disparate pieces of information the reporters had been accumulating for months. Those in the White House might dispute the interpretation in the lead, substituting the phrases political intelligence gathering and pranks for political spying and sabotage. But the facts supported the aggressive language. Specific examples of some of the tactics listed in the fifth and sixth paragraphs were lacking, but the hard evidence was in the Canuck letter and Segretti's activities. Hopefully the story would push the missing examples into the open. Shumway's statement ran as the seventh paragraph, accompanied by the refusal of the White House to comment on the story. The next 10 paragraphs dealt with the Canuck letter. They reported that Ken Clawson had told Marilyn Berger on September 25th that he had written the letter and recorded his denial. The Segretti findings weren't mentioned until the 18th paragraph, the point at which the story was continued in the inside of the paper. The involvement of at least 50 undercover Nixon operatives who traveled throughout the country trying to disrupt and spy on Democratic campaigns was not mentioned until the 19th paragraph. And the remaining text of the 65-paragraph story was a narrative of Segretti's travels, job approaches, conversation with Bob Myers, and biographical details. The four-column, two-line head of the top half of page one read, "FBI finds Nixon aides sabotage Democrats." The story went out over the Washington Post, Los Angeles Times News Service wire about 7 p.m. More than half of the 220 domestic subscribers used the story, several on page one, and non-subscriber coverage was broad. In the newsroom of the New York Times Washington Bureau, less than five blocks from the Post, a night editor began making hurried phone calls to senior editors in New York and members of the staff in Washington. Within 2 hours, the Times had contacted Shipley, Dixon, and Nixt, each of whom confirmed the approaches by Segretti. The Times' Late City edition of October 10th carried a story at the bottom of page one leading with Shipley's account, then summarizing the Post's allegations of a nationwide campaign of espionage and sabotage directed by the White House and CRP. At the White House that noon, Ron Ziegler faced an increasingly skeptical press corps determined to challenge the administration's refusal to discuss Watergate substantively. During a 30-minute briefing, a clearly uncomfortable presidential press secretary declined 29 times to discuss the Post story. His response was that CRP and Clawson had appropriately responded, and that the White House had nothing further to say. While Ziegler was fending off hostile questions in the West Wing, Bradley came over to Woodward's desk in the Post newsroom and sat down in a chair. "Hey, you and Carl and I got to have lunch this afternoon and have a little discussion," he said. Bernstein, however, was out of town, attending the funeral of a friend, the wife of his former boss. "Then you alone," Bradley said. "We gotta talk." They walked across 15th Street to the Madison Hotel's Montpellier room, an opulent French restaurant. Bradley asked for a corner table and began the conversation. "You'd better bring me up to date, because..." He turned to order lunch in perfect French, and then turned back to Woodward. Our cocks are on the chopping block now, and I just want to know a little more about this. Bradley had a general idea of who the reporter's sources were, but that's second-hand from Sussman and Rosenfeld, he said. I'd like it first-hand now, how the stories have been put together and where they're coming from. Bradley was a reporter by background and instinct. He understood the reluctance to discuss sources with anyone, including the editor. Tell me what you feel you can, he said. Just give me their positions and tell me again that you're sure and that Carl is sure, and that these are people who have no big axe to grind on the front page of the Washington Post. Bradley fidgeted in his chair. He and Woodward discussed how the stories had been covered, how the reporters had dealt with sources, and under what circumstances they had met and communicated. The line was drawn at a point which satisfied Bradley's reportorial instincts and responsibilities as an editor, as well as Bernstein and Woodward's promises of anonymity to their sources. After more than an hour, Bradley said, "Well, okay, I'm satisfied. Now, what have you guys got for tomorrow?" Bradley liked to keep the pressure on. The reporters were working two major areas, Woodward told him. A White House Segretti connection, and a whole catalog of dirty tricks that had plagued the Muskie campaign. But neither story would be ready for the next day. At 3 p.m., when the editors filed into Bradley's office for the daily story conference, they considered two items as possible front-page follow-ups. The White House reaction, or lack of it, as expressed by Ron Ziegler, and the demand by Senator Muskie that President Nixon personally answer press reports of wrongdoing by White House staff members because the allegations were so serious. Muskie had insisted that any investigation of the case be done outside the Justice Department, saying it was inconceivable that the president's lawyers there could objectively investigate corruption of the president's staff. Neither story generated much enthusiasm. Rosenfeld told Woodward that the editors were concerned. The lack of a strong follow-up could be interpreted as pulling back on the part of the Post. He urged Woodward to keep trolling for a story. About 6 o'clock, Frank Mankiewicz, the crafty professional of the McGovern campaign, called Woodward. He had a list of 10 acts of alleged sabotage against the McGovern campaign, acts so well engineered that they must have come from the Republicans, Mankiewicz said. They ranged from the serious, an attempt by someone impersonating a top McGovern aide to set up a bogus meeting between the candidate and the AFL-CIO president George Meany, to harassing phone calls received on the switchboard at McGovern headquarters. In one instance, according to Mankiewicz, someone had impersonated him in a call to CBS-TV anchorman Walter Cronkite, and had referred to a deal in which Cronkite had allegedly agreed to give 80% of the news coverage on the CBS Evening News to McGovern and the remaining 20% to Nixon. The Mankiewicz impersonator told Cronkite, who later confirmed that he had received such a call, "But everyone's getting suspicious. Better give more to Nixon." Mankiewicz said that Cronkite later told him that the guy was definitely not just a crank. It was a very good imitation. Woodward asked Mankiewicz if there was any evidence connecting the acts of sabotage to the White House or the Nixon re-election committee. "No," said Mankiewicz, "but it sure sounded like part of the same operation the Post had written about that morning." Rosenfeld wanted a page-one story on the Mankiewicz charges. Woodward argued strongly that the Post lacked evidence that the incidents were part of the broad CRP campaign. He was concerned that readers might justifiably conclude that the McGovern campaign was jumping onto a sabotage bandwagon. Why hadn't McGovern's people made the charges earlier? Ziegler's reaction was a more legitimate story, but Woodward was overruled by Rosenfeld and the senior editors. Woodward continued protesting, even after he wrote a piece which stated pointedly that Mankiewicz had supplied no evidence connecting the activities with the president's campaign. The story was headlined, "Democrats Step Up Sabotage Charges." It would only serve to fuel White House charges that the Post and the McGovern campaign were conspiring in the last desperate days of the Democrats' campaign. Bernstein, who had arrived back in Washington in the midst of the argument between Woodward and the editors, was doubly chagrined. He was a few phone calls away from confirming the last act in a long list of sabotage attempts against the Muskie campaign.
The day after he had talked to Alex Shipley, Bernstein had begun calling Muskie staffers. One by one, they had told horror stories about how their campaign had been repeatedly victimized by unexplained accidents that seemed as if they could only be the results of an organized effort. Stolen documents, fake campaign literature, canceled rallies, outrageous telephone calls to voters in the name of Muskie campaign workers, schedule breakdowns, and, of course, the Canuck letter. Still, almost all agreed the Muskie campaign had self-destructed because of the candidate's vacillation on the issues, and because of what they regarded as his ineptitude. They didn't know who was responsible for the vicious things that kept occurring, but whoever had done them had been guilty of gross overkill. Some had guessed Hubert Humphrey's backers, others George Wallace's. Bernstein had traveled with Muskie as a reporter for a week during the 1968 campaign, when the senator was the Democratic vice presidential nominee, and knew him slightly. He wanted to get to Muskie before anything was printed in the Post, suggesting his bid for the presidency had been the object of sabotage. Woodward had been told by Roger Wilkins, a Post editorial writer — Wilkins wrote the Post's major editorials on Watergate — that Muskie had sought legal advice during the campaign when he suspected members of his family were being followed and investigated. Wilkins, the former director of the Justice Department's Community Relations Service under Attorney General Ramsey Clark and the 40-year-old nephew of NAACP President Roy Wilkins, had said, "Muskie got a lawyer because one of his children was being followed and inquiries were being made at the child's school." Bernstein's meeting with Muskie on Capitol Hill lasted more than an hour. With no prodding, Muskie revealed that he had long suspected that the Nixon forces were behind a systematic campaign of sabotage that had harmed his campaign. "Our campaign was constantly plagued by leaks and disruptions and fabrications," Muskie said, "but we could never pinpoint who was doing it. Somebody was out to ambush us. We assumed it was being done by Nixon people, because that's the nature of this administration. They have no sensitivity to privacy or decency in politics. But we had no proof it was them." Muskie described more than a dozen incidents he suspected were the results of sabotage, covering much the same ground as members of his staff. Since he had learned in 1970 that FBI agents had been assigned to report on a speech he made for Earth Day on April 22nd of that year, the senator said, "I have assumed I've been followed by the Republicans." Had members of his family been followed? "We thought we were being followed, but we were never able to establish a connection with Republican espionage." The senator refused to be more specific or talk about what, if anything, had happened with one of his children. "Whatever happened with members of my family is private," he said. His tone, angry and insistent, conveyed real bitterness. Bernstein kept trying to find out what might be behind it. He asked Muskie if somebody had tried to learn something specific about one of the children, like whether they smoked dope. "I'm just not going to talk about it," Muskie said. On October 12th, Bernstein wrote a story on the sabotage of the Muskie campaign, based on interviews and memoranda obtained from Muskie and his staff before the October 10th story had been published. He had been able to confirm that, in July 1971, facsimiles of Muskie's Senate stationery were used to mail a Harris poll reprint dealing with Senator Edward Kennedy and the incident at Chappaquiddick to Democratic members of Congress. It resulted in complaints to Muskie about unethical campaigning. On April 17, 1972, a Muskie fundraising dinner at the Washington Hilton Hotel had been harassed as unordered liquor, flowers, pizzas, cakes, and entertainers arrived COD. Several days before the Florida primary, a flyer on bogus Muskie stationery was distributed, accusing both Senator Humphrey and Senator Henry Jackson of illicit sexual conduct. During the New Hampshire primary campaign, voters had been awakened in the middle of the night by phone calls from persons who identified themselves as canvassers from the Harlem for Muskie Committee, urging that New Hampshire voters cast their ballots for Muskie because he'd been so good for the black man. During 1971, raw polling data twice disappeared from the desk of the Muskie polling expert at campaign headquarters. This convinced Muskie that he had a middle-level spy. And members of Muskie's staff said they were subsequently warned by columnist Roland Evans that there was a spy in their camp. Woodward was reading over the Muskie story in the October 12th paper when Robert Myers called from Los Angeles that morning. He had found Larry Young, a fraternity brother of Segretti's during their USC undergraduate days, who was to have been the other half of the firm Young and Segretti. Segretti had told Young a good deal about his connections with the Nixon campaign. Woodward started typing. Segretti told Young that the FBI found out about him from telephone records, from the phone of E. Howard Hunt. A lot of phone calls one way, all from Hunt to Segretti. Hunt would give him instructions, but Young doesn't know what events the specific instructions were connected to. It wasn't the bugging. Woodward was amazed. It hadn't occurred to the reporters that Segretti's operation was tied to Hunt's plans. Segretti said to Young, "I'm working for a wealthy California Republican lawyer with national connections, and I get paid by a special lawyer's trust fund." Kalmbach. Woodward asked Myers if he had tried the name of the president's personal lawyer on Young. Myers said Young didn't know who Kalmbach was. Young is convinced that Segretti met with Dwight Chapin and with Hunt, because Segretti talked about his going to Miami to meet with all the key people he had always worked with on the phone. And he had earlier told Young that it was Hunt, and Chapin was the general organizer. Segretti would always say, "I have to talk with D.C. I have to meet with D.C. At first, Young thought he meant District of Columbia. Then he became convinced D.C. was Dwight Chapin. Young, too, is said by others to have been a good friend of the USC Republican Mafia and kept contacts with them. In Miami, Young thinks Segretti met with Hunt and Chapin and also was asked, don't know by whom, to recruit and organize Cubans for an assault on the Doral Beach Hotel and make it look as if they were working for McGovern. Segretti refused because he felt it would be blatantly illegal and violent. For months, the reporters had been picking up information suggesting that the Nixon forces had made routine use of provocateurs in demonstrations, and that such things had been planned for the conventions. But they had assumed that all bets were off after Watergate. Yet there had been an assault on the Doral Beach Hotel in Miami, and there was some evidence that there had been provocateurs in the crowd. Woodward remembered Deep Throat's words four nights before, "These are not very bright guys." Somehow the bungling seemed reassuring. It tempered the frightening implications of how far the Nixon forces were willing to go to achieve their ends. Where would their efforts have ended had not the Watergate burglars been so incredibly stupid as to retape the stairwell doors on June 17th, leading a security guard to call the cops? Or if Howard Hunt, the supposed master spy, had exercised the elementary caution of using payphones? Woodward went into Sussman's office. The city editor and Bernstein were agonizing over how tantalizingly close they were to establishing Segretti's contact with Chapin. Myers' information from Young established the connection, but Young was not yet willing to go on record. They went over Woodward's notes. That afternoon, Bernstein reached Young at his office in Los Angeles. They talked for more than an hour. Young told him, "Segretti called me in a panic in August. It was about 2 weeks before the Republican convention. He said he had just been visited by the FBI and wanted to talk to me very quickly. He was worried because there had been no prior warning that he would be contacted by the FBI. He had felt he would be given such a prior warning that he would be briefed as to what to say. He wouldn't say who was to brief him, just that they were the people he was working for. He was afraid of being left out on a limb, sacrificed without any protection or coverage. He wanted some advice as to what he should do. Don told me that he was paid from a trust account in a lawyer's name. He said the lawyer was a high-placed friend of the president, and he was instructed to guard that name zealously. He would never divulge any names." Bernstein pressed for anything Young could remember about the lawyer. Young thought, "Oh, yes, he once said the lawyer was in the Newport Beach area." Kalmbach lived in Newport Beach, and maintained his offices there. A high-placed friend of the president, a lawyer, Newport Beach. How had Segretti characterized his political activities to Young?
Segretti said to me he was engaged in activities that he called political hijinks, that this was part of the president's re-election drive, that it was supposed to create trouble and problems for various Democratic candidates. After he was summoned to the grand jury, he tried to get in touch with his people who were in Miami Beach for the convention. He was in an absolute panic, even more concerned than when the FBI first visited him. He felt he should have been given prior warning. He was trying to call Chapin. I said, "Have you talked to Dwight about this?" He gave an evasive answer and said he couldn't get a hold of anyone. He was very concerned with Dwight's name. Then I got a call around midnight from him saying he was on his way to Miami, that he had made contact, he wouldn't say with whom, and they had told him to come to Miami. He said in Miami that he was shown an FBI report of his interrogation, both of them. And he was told to tell the truth before the grand jury, not to perjure himself, not to worry about it. He was to stick to just what he had told the FBI, which was not any damaging material, just about phone calls from Hunt and some small activities he was doing, some innocuous thing about being involved in some campaign activities. None of the stuff that hit the paper later. When he reported to wherever they report, the U.S. attorney interrogated him ahead of time in an office and thoroughly went into everything. But in the grand jury, the questions went along on a very easy scale. Just the innocuous stuff, and some things about Hunt. Nothing about the lawyer. Nothing about whom he was working for. But then, he said, a woman member of the grand jury asked a question about who paid him, and whom he knew on the White House staff. Then he said the names came out, especially Dwight Chapin's. He didn't mention the other names to me. He said he did tell the grand jury the name of the lawyer on the West Coast who paid him. Now it was definite. The Justice Department had had the information that the president's appointment secretary and his personal lawyer were involved and had done nothing to follow up. Bernstein again wondered how the prosecutors could have been manipulated to accept such a decision. "He told the prosecutors truthfully everything that he knew," Young had said. Bernstein asked Young for other specific details of what Segretti had told him. "He mentioned a letter or pamphlet for mailing to all members of the Democratic State Central Committee in California, a scurrilous attack on Humphrey, blaming him for the war, calling him a two-time loser, giving the impression it was put out by McGovern people. He said there were some others doing the same thing. He said, 'I'm just a small fish, a cog, one of many doing the same thing.'"
"And Chapin?"
"My impression is that Don and Dwight are very close as good friends could be. They kept contact over the years. He mentioned that he called Dwight at his home in connection with this, but he's been somewhat secretive with me."
"How much had he said about Howard Hunt?"
"When the FBI came to see him the first time, he learned that his phone number had turned up on a bill to an individual named Howard Hunt. He said he knew Hunt by a different name, an assumed name, a pseudonym, but that he knew he was Hunt. Hunt would always talk in a very whispery, conspiratorial voice, he said, and he thought Hunt was very odd. Hunt seemed to add even more intrigue than was already there, he said." The conversation had been off the record, but Young said he would consider putting it on, provided he received legal advice that no violation of the attorney-client privilege was involved. Segretti had never retained him as counsel, had sought him out only as a friend, Young said. He and Bernstein and Woodward and Myers would stay in touch daily. On Friday, October 13th, Young agreed to go on the record. Woodward went over the details with him a final time, pressing to find if there was any possibility that Young could be wrong or exaggerating Segretti's dealings with Hunt and Chapin. The answer was no. Myers was dispatched to get a sworn statement from Young affirming that the contents of the interviews with Myers, Bernstein, and Woodward were accurate representations of what Segretti had told him. At last, there was going to be a story based almost completely on on-the-record statements that could not be attacked by the White House as coming from anonymous sources.
For 2 days, Woodward had been trying to telephone Chapin at his office in the White House, a few steps from the Oval Office of the President. His calls, for the first time, were held up at the switchboard, while he was asked who was calling and from what number. After about 20 seconds, the calls were put through, but when he reached Chapin's office, the secretary would say Chapin was busy and take a message. The calls were not returned. There remained one major hurdle. Myers had described Larry Young as a defender of radicals and cop killers. No phrase was more likely to raise a red flag in Harry Rosenfeld's office. The Metropolitan editor bluntly said he was not about to stake his reputation or that of the Washington Post on the word of some hippie lawyer. Happily, Larry Young's credentials were in order. Woodward made a dozen telephone calls to the West Coast and spent hours talking to members of the bench and bar who vouched for Young's standing as a respected and responsible representative of the legal profession. Woodward even found out what kind of clothes Young wore. Modish, but tasteful. And how long his hair was. Shorter than Bernstein's. Rosenfeld was satisfied. Bernstein began writing the story, and Woodward left to make a round of visits at the Justice Department. After several strikeouts, he found a lawyer familiar with the case alone in his office. Woodward was invited in and sat down. An informal late Friday afternoon mood prevailed. They began chatting about Tuesday's story, the espionage and sabotage in the primaries. "Yes, we got Segretti through the records of Hunt's phone calls," the lawyer said. "The Bureau made random checks on a large portion of Hunt's calls. There were more than 700 calls altogether. One of them was to this guy, Segretti. Let me emphasize that the dirty tricks were probably not illegal, and here at Justice we're sticking to the Watergate bugging itself in the investigation. But I'm worried about the case. The Bureau is acting funny. There's an interest in the case at the top." He wouldn't say where the top was. Now, more than ever, it was clear why the Watergate investigation had been so narrowly focused that the prosecutors had not pursued other crimes, no matter how obvious, unless they were directly connected to the bugging. Woodward read aloud some notes on the Chapin-Segretti connection, and suggested they might explain high-level interest. He didn't know if the attorney would be surprised or not. After some hesitation, the attorney said, "That's essentially what we've been told." Woodward said he was a little afraid of the story because it led straight to the White House, to the gatekeeper at the Oval Office, which was one of Chapin's functions. The lawyer smiled. "I've wondered several times why you would worry so much about Chapin, who's much lower than Mitchell and Stans." "What you've been told, we've been told about Segretti and Chapin. I can talk about it a little more freely because it really doesn't have anything to do with Watergate. It was part of the investigation, technically still is, but it's separate, and we're not pursuing it." About 5 p.m., the reporters and editors met to discuss the Chapin story. It would be too long to finish in a couple of hours. They would hold it for Sunday. The Justice Department had turned away from investigating the real conspiracy of Watergate, had focused on the narrow burglary and bugging at Democratic headquarters. The IOC, interception of oral communications, as the feds called it, and ignored the grand conspiracy directed by the president's men to subvert the electoral process. Woodward called a casual acquaintance at the White House to get some background on Chapin. "He's one of those guys, like Haldeman and Pat Buchanan, one of the president's speechwriters and the author of the White House daily news summaries, who got on the old man's bus very early and followed it through the ups and downs," he was told. "Chapin's the guy who made sure the old man's suit came back from the cleaners during the campaign. He made sure everyone had coffee and made apologies when the president was late, including calls to Mrs. Nixon and the girls. He probably gave the president a back rub if he needed one during the 68 campaign. Dwight is nice to everyone, always says hello." The decision to hold the story for Sunday had been made after Woodward called the White House on Friday for comment. About 8 p.m., 3 hours after he had been told the substance of the story, Deputy Press Secretary Gerald Warren called back. "I have a statement from Dwight Chapin," he said. As the Washington Post reporter has described it, the story is based entirely on hearsay and is fundamentally inaccurate. For example, I do not know, have never met, seen, or talked to E. Howard Hunt. I have known Donald Segretti since college days, but I didn't meet with him in Florida, as the story suggests, and I certainly have never discussed with him any phase of the grand jury proceedings in the Watergate case. Beyond that, I don't propose to have any further comment. Chapin, busily answering charges that had not been leveled against him, ignored the main point, that he was Segretti's contact. Fundamentally inaccurate was employed much as collection of absurdities had been to describe the initial Segretti espionage sabotage story, along with the old hearsay red herring. The hearsay charge rankled. The Post had a sworn statement from Larry Young. At 9 p.m., when Bernstein sat down to write, he had three versions of the Young interviews, his own, Woodward's, and Myers. The clutter on his desk was hopeless, so he moved to three vacant desks near his own and laid out 5 yards of notes. By 7 a.m., he had 15 pages, which quoted extensively from Young. Only the biographical details on Chapin remained to be written. He flopped down on a couch in the sports department and got less than 2 hours of uncomfortable sleep before being awakened by a copy aide. Bernstein wanted the story to be completed early, so it could be reviewed by Rosenfeld, Simons, and Bradley without any last-minute hassles. He had looked through the library at the Post for more background on Chapin. There was only one half-page handout issued by the 1968 Nixon Campaign Organization. It said that Chapin had been graduated from USC and had worked for the J. Walter Thompson Advertising Agency under Bob Haldeman. Bernstein added details from Myers's notes. At about 9:30 a.m., he called the former administration official he had talked to the week after the Watergate arrests. The man knew Chapin well. "If Dwight has anything to do with this, it means Haldeman," he said. Chapin was no self-starter. "He does what two people tell him to do, Haldeman and Nixon." Woodward and Sussman arrived at the office that Saturday at about 10 a.m. and began going over Bernstein's draft. There was no problem with the lead. It was the same as read to the White House. President Nixon's appointment secretary and an ex-White House aide indicted in the Watergate bugging case both served as contacts in a spying and sabotage operation against the Democrats, a California attorney has said in a sworn statement. Sussman was concerned that the top section of the draft did not adequately stress Chapin's position in the White House, that it conveyed the impression that he was merely some flunky calendar keeper who worked out of a closet. He typed out a new second paragraph. "The appointment secretary, Dwight L. Chapin, 31, meets almost daily with the president. As the person in charge of Mr. Nixon's schedule and appointments, including overall coordination of trips, Chapin is one of a handful of White House staff members with easy access to the president." Bernstein was pleased with the addition, but he protested when the next paragraph, describing Chapin as a functionary who responded to orders from Haldeman, was struck from the draft. Anger turned to anguish when the following paragraph was struck. An observation that Larry Young's description of the Newport Beach lawyer who allegedly paid Segretti appears to fit Herbert W. Kalmbach, the president's personal attorney and former deputy finance chairman of the Nixon campaign. Woodward had tried to reach Kalmbach on Friday and been told by Kalmbach's secretary that no member of the firm would comment to reporters on anything. Now Bernstein was prepared to argue strenuously, but Woodward joined the editors and said he preferred to kill the paragraph until Kalmbach was contacted, or until another source specifically identified Kalmbach as Segretti's paymaster. Bernstein conceded that they should be able to confirm Kalmbach's tie to Segretti within a few days, as well as to identify the president's lawyer as one of the 5 persons with overall control of the secret funds that had financed the campaign of espionage and sabotage. A new paragraph was added, quoting Young as saying that the money for Segretti's activities, including a $20,000 annual salary, was paid from a trust account in a lawyer's name, a highly placed friend of the president, and that Segretti was instructed to guard that name zealously. Despite the deletions, the story, headlined Key Nixon Aide Named as Sabotage Contact, broke new ground. Almost 4 months after the break-in at Democratic headquarters, the spreading stain of Watergate had finally seeped into the White House. Chapter 8 Bernstein had left Washington Saturday night to spend the rest of the weekend in the Virginia countryside, horseback riding. When Woodward awoke Sunday, the radio news was quoting the Post story, as well as a press release from Time magazine dealing with the Segretti-Chapin connection. Time's story was better than the Post's in some respects, though it was based on anonymous government sources and lacked any personal account, such as Young's, it had several additional details. Chapin had hired Segretti, not merely served as his contact. Another USC alumnus, Gordon Strachan, the political aide to Haldeman, also had a hand in hiring his old classmate. Segretti had been paid more than $35,000 by Herbert W. Kalmbach, the president's lawyer. Woodward, his Sunday shot to hell by Time magazine, not for the first nor the last time, he was sure, went to the office and started working the telephone. Late in the afternoon, he reached a Justice Department attorney whose overriding interest seemed to be getting back to the television set to watch a football game. He hurriedly confirmed that Kalmbach was indeed the paymaster for Segretti's secret activities. Woodward didn't even have time to ask him about Gordon Strachan. Woodward called Hugh Sloan. Working around the edges, the two talked for a few minutes about Kalmbach's role in the campaign. Kalmbach had resigned as deputy finance chairman on April 7th, the date the new campaign finance disclosure law took effect. Until Maurice Stans resigned as secretary of commerce, Kalmbach had been in charge of fundraising for the president's re-election, although Stans was doing political work while still at commerce. There was very little about the financial side of the Nixon campaign that Kalmbach did not know, Sloan said, even after he resigned his position. Then Kalmbach had to be one of the five persons with authority to approve disbursements from the secret stash in Stans's safe, Woodward suggested. Well, yes, Sloan said, but he had some of the money in California. The money from Stans's safe? It was all really one cash fund, whether it was in California or Washington, Sloan said. It had all showed up on the same burned books. It was a special projects fund. For espionage and political sabotage? That's what it was, but I didn't know it at the time, said Sloan. He responded with resignation offhandedly, like a patient recounting a bad dream to a psychiatrist for the fourth time. Kalmbach had distributed other money from the fund far in excess of the amount received by Segretti, Sloan said. But he would not disclose how much or to whom. The cash fund seems to be at the center of this, he understated. Woodward called Bernstein in the country and filled him in. Bernstein agreed that Kalmbach's control over the fund was more important than the payments to Segretti and should lead the story Woodward would write. It would also include the Time material on Strachan, which Woodward had been unable to confirm. This time the White House did not trouble to comment, and the next day's front page of the Washington Post carried a two-column head above Herbert Kalmbach's picture. Lawyer for Nixon said to have used GOP's spy fund. Woodward had taken time out to watch John D. Ehrlichman's appearance on ABC's Issues and Answers. On TV, Ehrlichman resembled a snarling prune, he thought, one eyebrow cocked high, the other low. He was saying that everything in the papers about the Nixon campaign's program of political espionage and sabotage involved a lot of charges, not much proof, not any proof. He suggested that the McGovern campaign was somehow responsible for the allegations which people were reading in their newspapers and hearing on television. Reminding the audience that the election was only 3 weeks away, Ehrlichman said this was the mud month, when political charges would be thrown around. He wasn't personally aware of any campaign of political espionage mounted by Republicans in or out of the administration, he said. Certainly nobody in the White House had known anything about Watergate in advance. He couldn't affirm or deny the charge that Chapin was involved with Segretti. But, he added, it was important to distinguish between the Watergate bugging, which involves a crime, and such activities as finding out what the other fellow's schedule is. Political pranks, said Ehrlichman, that kind of thing has been in American politics as long as I can remember. Woodward and Bernstein concluded that Ehrlichman was perhaps the only high White House aide clean enough on Watergate to be safely trotted out before the TV cameras. Haldeman sure as hell couldn't be sent out, not after the Chapin story. Both felt certain that Ehrlichman's appearance signaled that he was clear. Maybe Deep Throat had been wrong when he said Ehrlichman had ordered Howard Hunt out of town. Ehrlichman's remarks on television were a mild prelude. The Chapin connection had brought Watergate to the doors of the Oval Office. Now the White House was ready to fight back. Although Time had developed information as damaging as the Washington Post's, the paper had been selected as the target. It began with Ron Ziegler's White House briefing the next morning, October 16th. "Mr. Chapin has made a comment on that, and I don't have anything to add to it," Ziegler responded to the first question concerning the Segretti connection. Question: is the president concerned about the report? Ziegler: the president is concerned about the technique being applied by the opposition in the stories themselves. I would say his concern goes to the fact that stories are being run that are based on hearsay, innuendo, guilt by association. Question: who is the opposition? Ziegler: well, I think the opposition is clear. You know, since the Watergate case broke, people have been trying to link the case with the White House, and no link has been established because no link exists. Since that time, the opposition has been making charges which are not substantiated. Stories have been written which are not substantiated. Stories have been written that are based upon hearsay and on sources that will not reveal themselves. And all of this is being intermingled into an allegation that this administration, as the opposition points out, is corrupt. That is what I'm referring to, and I'm not going to comment on that type of story. Question: why don't you deny the charges? Ziegler: I'm not going to dignify these types of stories with a comment. It goes without saying that this administration does not condone sabotage or espionage or surveillance of individuals. But it also does not condone innuendo or source stories that make broad, sweeping charges about the character of individuals. The White House had decided that the conduct of the press, not the conduct of the president's men, was the issue. The president has confidence in Mr. Chapin, Ziegler concluded. Speaking to an assembly of black Republicans at a downtown Washington hotel that afternoon, Senator Bob Dole, the Republican national chairman, delivered 3 pages of prepared remarks designed to link the Post's investigative reporting with the failing fortunes of Senator McGovern's campaign. Less restrained than Ziegler, Dole got right to the point. For the last week, the Republican Party has been the victim of a barrage of unfounded and unsubstantiated allegations by George McGovern and his partner in mudslinging, the Washington Post. Given the present straits in which the McGovern campaign finds itself, Mr. McGovern appears to have turned over the franchise for his media attack campaign to the editors of the Washington Post, who have shown themselves every bit as sure-footed along the low road of this campaign as their candidate. While wire service stories on Dole's and Ziegler's statements piled up, the reporters were told that Clark McGregor, Mitchell's successor as director of the Nixon campaign, had scheduled a 5 p.m. press conference to discuss the latest charges of political espionage and sabotage. Both reporters hated press conferences and rarely attended them, but Bernstein decided to go to this one. He had never seen McGregor, and wanted to find out if his reputation of being open with reporters was deserved. When Bernstein arrived in the large conference room at CRP headquarters shortly before 5, an unusually large crowd of about 100 reporters was waiting. McGregor entered the room from the rear and walked up the middle aisle. He is a big man, 6'3", about 210 pounds. Arriving at the lectern, he grabbed both sides of it and gave a half-hearted smile. Because of the unusual developments of the past few days, McGregor said, he would be unable to answer any questions. Clark Mullenhoff, 6'4" and 230 pounds, Washington bureau chief of the Des Moines Register and Tribune Syndicate, rose, his face contorted in anger. Mullenhoff, a Pulitzer Prize-winning investigative reporter, had briefly served at the White House as resident ombudsman, charged with